From New England Public Radio in Springfield, Massachusetts, this is NEPR News Now. Stories you really should not miss. Thanks for listening. I'm Sam Hudzik, the news director at New England Public Radio. On this episode, a pair of reporters wanted to figure out why fraudulent behavior in a state drug lab in Eastern Mass received far more attention and follow-up than a similar case in Western Mass.
I kept calling people and saying, why? Why aren't there more answers? Why don't we have a list of all of the affected cases? Why are they being handled so differently?
She says the answers made her beat her head against a wall. Then a former Boston city councilor has a cheeky idea. Sell the Massachusetts State House, make it condos, and move the state capital to Springfield.
It would help Springfield. It really would. And it wouldn't really hurt Boston. Boston would be fine. In fact, we'd probably have a little bit less traffic, and that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, so we'll have more on that coming up. Also, another pick from our Back to School book series, and remembering the great cookbook editor, Judith Jones.
She liked a pudding we had quickly dismissed, a cornmeal porridge, straw-colored with earthy hints of molasses and ginger that took a while to unfold. Genuine, she said, Yankee, flinty.
All that coming up on NEPR News Now. But first, the small white sign outside the library in Williamsburg, Massachusetts, usually just lists the library's hours. That changed after the violent white nationalist rally earlier this month in Charlottesville. That was a turning point for Meekins Library Director Katie Kroll. She says those images of Klan members and Nazis made her scared that history was repeating itself. She decided to end her moratorium on commenting on anything political at the public library.
It was thinking on it and wondering what I could do that was possible for the library and what would work and how I could grab people's attention without really being overtly grabbing their attention.
And on her drive to work,
the song just came into my head. It was just that simple.
We'll make the angels cry.
Get Together, a song from the 1960s that's since been used on commercials for fried chicken, Pepsi, diapers. On the sign outside the Williamsburg Library, Kroll posted the first line of the chorus. Come on, people now.
Come on, people now. Smile on your brother. Everybody get together. Try to love one another right now.
The lyrics don't click for everyone. On Facebook, one commenter wrote that he didn't get it. But Kroll says she's heard nothing but positive feedback. It is, after all, a pretty careful message.
I thought it was safe enough. It was just simply everyone get together, talk, respect each other.
Kroll was thinking it might soon be time to take down the sign. But after talking it over with her staff, she's now going to put up the second line of the chorus.
Smile on your brother, everybody get together, try to love one another right now.
Four years ago, a chemist with the state drug lab in Amherst, Massachusetts, was arrested for stealing drugs for herself and tampering with evidence. Sonia Farrakh's case came on the heels of another scandal in eastern Massachusetts, in which state chemist Annie Dukan was convicted of evidence tampering. Two reporters for the Daily Hampshire Gazette, Amanda Drain and Emily Cutts, looked into a scathing report by Judge Richard Carey. In it, he accuses prosecutors of misconduct when investigating the fallout of Farrakh's case. New England Public Radio's Karen Brown asked them how the two drug lab cases were dealt with differently. Cutts starts by describing how much effort went into the first investigation.
It took 15 months to investigate. They appointed an attorney to come up with a list of all the people that Dukan's actions could have affected. And none of that happened.
None of the investigation happened.
They had this groundwork. They didn't have to reinvent the wheel. And yet nothing that had happened in the Dukan case and the Dukan investigation happened in the Farrakh case and the Farrakh investigation.
What is your sense on why Annie Dukan's case got so many more resources compared to what happened in the Amherst lab?
I don't think there's any one answer. But someone I interviewed on background for the story, they said it seemed like the state had drug lab crisis fatigue. or they'd allocated $30 million in a fund for Annie Dukin and spent a large portion of it. Then when things turned a corner on Sonia Farak, I think there was this collective sigh of not again.
Judge Carey, he overturned 7 cases, right, that Sonia Farak worked on. But it seems like there are thousands more at stake. You know, what is your sense on what the fallout is going to be for those? You know, is there going to be any follow-up? What are the defense attorneys doing?
I know that the defense attorneys have already taken aggressive action. And because I believe attorney Luke Ryan's actions, and after this case was, the Farak case was settled, he went and actually looked at the evidence that they had collected from her car when they arrested her and found the mental health worksheets that had not been disclosed before that Farak had filled out for her therapist that had detailed her drug use long before they had said she was using drugs.
Do you have any sense what has or hasn't changed in drug lab procedures since Farak was arrested?
The Massachusetts State Police has taken over the drug lab. It's no longer the Department of Health. It's the Massachusetts State Police.
And what about changes in the Massachusetts Attorney General's office? We have a different Attorney General now than we did when Sonia Farak was arrested.
The AG's spokespeople said that following Dukin and Farak, the office conducted training, particularly around the ethics behind releasing exculpatory evidence. I asked for more details on those trainings, but they were not provided.
I'm curious, as you guys were reporting the story, there was a lot about the difference between resources that are sent to Western Massachusetts versus Eastern Massachusetts. Did you find yourselves getting frustrated just as Western Mass residents that the government is putting more resources somewhere else?
For me personally, it wasn't a frustration over resources. It was a frustration of why can no one answer this question?
I agree. That was the biggest frustration. I kept calling people and saying, why? Why aren't there more answers? Why don't we have a list of all of the affected cases? Why are they being handled so differently? Why? And after beating my head against the wall and asking why so many times, I realized that this entire piece is meant to get at that.
That was Amanda Drain and Emily Cutts. You can read their reporting in the Daily Hampshire Gazette. A former Boston city councilor is offering a suggestion he says could help his city and Springfield. Mike Ross wrote a column in Boston Magazine saying Massachusetts should auction off its historic state house so it could become condos, and he'd make Springfield the new capital city. New England Public Radio's Carrie Healy called Ross up to ask if he was being serious. He says there was some hyperbole in his column.
But it kind of is meant to create questions and draw a conversation, which I hope this is, that Springfield needs attention and it needs resources. It needs to have more than one train trip to downtown Boston a day. And the economy itself in Springfield could use a boost. And so in Boston, where you have a real estate market on fire, you have tremendous economic development activity occurring, you know, perhaps it's not the craziest idea to talk about relocating the state capital. Other states have done it. You know, dozens of states have relocated their state capital. Many have done so with an eye towards economic development and thinking about, you know, how to stimulate their economy. I would think that Albany, New York is very happy to have the state capital there, as I would think is Springfield, Illinois, as opposed to the state capitals there being in respectively New York City and Chicago, which they're not. So I think there are models for it. I think it could be done, but you know, mostly it was just kind of an interesting idea that I thought I'd put on paper and see what kind of reaction we got.
Well, you did call Springfield New England's version of Detroit, citing the relatively high unemployment rate, the infrastructure challenges, closed factories. Okay, local boosters here would take issue with that. Okay, there are projects like the rail car manufacturer, the renovated Union Station, and that new casino set to open next year. So was this really about a love for Springfield?
You know, that might have been a little harsh, the Detroit comment. But even, you know, Detroit has its boosters who are watching that city participate in a renaissance. And Springfield needs a renaissance. I don't think there's a person in Springfield today that is happy with the way things are. If there is, please let me know. I mean, I think what you need in Springfield is an infusion of economic development, and I'm suggesting one way that it could happen. But I harbor no ill will towards Springfield. I feel kind of bad that the rest of the Commonwealth isn't doing as well. But I'm not surprised. Again, I mean, if you can't get there, then how, you know, that's start there, you know. So we need to recognize, I don't think the trick here is to throw platitudes at a city and hope it gets better. I think the trick is to figure out how we fix it.
Mm-hmm. I should say that we did reach out to Mayor Dominic Sarno for comment, and quite uncharacteristically, his office said no comment. You are a real estate attorney. Would you buy one of these state house condos?
I couldn't afford to buy one of these state house condos, and I do okay. I don't do that well. I think those state house condos would be, you know, easily probably $2 million a piece.
Okay, probability scale time. We'll call it zero being it's never going to happen, and 10 being you truly expect an avalanche of agreement from Beacon Hill. What are the chances that your dream happens and the state house gets sold and the Capitals move to Springfield?
You know, I'd put it like a 1.5 or a 2. I think that's even generous. But I think, you know, there could be a state rep or senator out there who's like, you know what? There are crazier ideas, and this might work. This could help us. And it would help Springfield. It really would. And it wouldn't really hurt Boston. Boston would be fine. In fact, we'd probably have a little bit less traffic, and that's not a bad thing.
Mike Ross is a lawyer in Boston and a former city councilor. We put a link to his column at NEPR.net. By the late 19th century, Hebrew was a language spoken only in prayer. But one man in Jerusalem, Ben Yehuda, went to great lengths to bring it back into common use among Jews around the world. Amherst, Massachusetts poet and author Rich Michelson described those efforts in his latest kids' book, The Language of Angels. For our back-to-school book series, Michelson tells me that Ben Yehuda made this his life's work.
I mean, it's absolutely amazing story that this one man was able to do that, to get this language reinvigorated. He had to make up a word for everything that had been invented in over 2,000 years. There was no word for ice cream, for bicycles, for libraries. And it's just an amazing story, and it's true.
And Ben Yehuda, part of his plan in order to bring Hebrew back involved his son. Can you talk about that a little bit?
So, yeah, he wanted his son, Ben Zion, to be the first child in over 2,000 years that grew up with Hebrew as his mother tongue. He wanted it to be his first language and, at the beginning, his only language. So he went to what we would call extreme measures. He would not allow anything but Hebrew to be spoken in when his son was around, which, of course, meant that his son had no friends because nobody else spoke Hebrew in the entire Jerusalem. Eliezer ben Yehuda went so far as to not allow his son even to hear the sounds of animals. If cows were mooing or dogs were barking, he'd cover his ears. So it's really basically child abuse, for sure. You know, because it ended up okay, and because his son grew up to revere his father, and in fact wrote his biography, became a normal person, a journalist, we kind of can look past the point that he was basically abused as a child.
Well, I want to talk about that. So the father, Ben Yehuda, he's the hero of this book, but, you know, he's a deeply flawed one, and he doesn't get comeuppance. I kept thinking as I was reading this, are you confident that a kid leaving this book doesn't take from that, you know, ends justify the means in this? I mean, he abused his son as a way to achieve his own goals.
I'm confident, in fact, that that's not the overriding story of the book.
But are you confident that kids will get that that's
yes,
not the
overriding? Yes, I think that, and because I have read this book to kids all over the country, and what kids really, the first thing they get is, oh, wow, he got to make up a name for ice cream. He got to make up a name for this. And kids are very sophisticated. They understand, you know, their parents' pluses and minuses, their flaws, their weaknesses, also the love that encompasses. And I think that in the end, the good and the love between father and son, which ended up being a very strong facet of Ben Zion's life, he dedicated his life to championing his dad. And I think that what kids are getting from this book, which makes me happy because it's what I wanted them to get, is that they can make up words.
Did this book make you want to learn how to speak Hebrew?
You know, no. you know, it's funny. So many of my books are about different subjects. You know, I have a book on Lippmann Pike, the first home run king. I'm not a baseball fan, although I know more about baseball right now in the 1880s than I think about anybody else in the country. but I couldn't tell you the name of 10 players playing today. I wrote a book on the Savoy Ballroom in 20s Harlem, I Can't Dance. I love learning about things. And my enthusiasm for that is what I hope I put into the books. And also one of the reasons I enjoy writing for kids is that the questions that I have about a subject, because I don't know anything about it when I start, are often the same questions that kids have when they're learning about something. So in many ways, my ignorance is valuable for me.
That was Rich Michelson, author of The Language of Angels, a story about the reinvention of Hebrew. You can find more selections from our Back to School book series at NEPR.net. Earlier this month, renowned cookbook editor Judith Jones died in her Vermont home at age 93. Jones is celebrated for editing Mastering the Art of French Cooking and introducing Julia Child to the world. Commentator Martha Ackman once judged a cooking contest with Jones in Western Massachusetts.
A number of years ago, a friend invited me to judge a cooking contest in Hawley. My friend is nothing if not enterprising and had organized the Pudding Hollow Pudding Festival, an event commemorating a 1780 contest to determine who could cook Hawley's largest pudding. Abigail Baker was the winner back then and was declared the official pudding head. Her winning entry was a hasty pudding in a 5-pail kettle. For this century's contest, I was one of several judges asked to sample dishes and select a winner. Not the biggest pudding this time around, but the best tasting. We judges assembled ourselves before the dishes and made quick introductions. There was a local public servant who announced he was a diabetic and then spooned right into the butterscotch. And there was a woman, quiet, plainly dressed. She shook my hand. "Judith," she said. While dipping into puddings, we compared notes. The town officer and I liked a razzle-dazzle tapioca, strawberries and blueberries nestled in a translucent custard, a red, white, and blue showstopper. Then Judith spoke. She liked a pudding we had quickly dismissed, a cornmeal porridge, straw-colored with earthy hints of molasses and ginger that took a while to unfold. "Genuine," she said, "Yankee, flinty." My fellow judge and I nodded, but hardly heard the comment. We were on to the next swallow, more eager to be wowed than linger over subtlety. In the end, we tapioca fans ruled the day, and Judith accepted defeat graciously. Several months later, I was watching a PBS special on Julia Child when I fully realized who Judith was. To say I was embarrassed to have voted down her choice is an understatement. My encounter with Judith Jones taught me about the integrity of the authentic, the deception of the flashy and momentary, and the virtue of holding your tongue even when you know better than those around you. Jones certainly knew her way around cooking. But what's been missing in all the accolades following her death is she also knew a little something about table manners.
Martha Ackman lives in Leverett, Massachusetts. Her new book on Emily Dickinson will be published next year. This podcast is produced by New England Public Radio, a listener-supported public media company that brings you news and music and NEPR.net. Check it out, and while you're there, you can make a contribution to New England Public Radio. Click the orange Donate button at the top of the screen. Thank you so much for listening. You can subscribe to any of New England Public Radio's podcasts wherever you get your podcasts or at NEPR.net/podcast. Until next time.